Shalom and welcome to Neshama Cast, exploring Jewish spiritual care today. Brought to you by Neshama, Association of Jewish Chaplains. I'm your host, Rabbi Ed Bernstein. Welcome to a bonus edition of Neshama Cast. This is part 4 in the series Let's Talk, Interfaith Voices on Israel. In this series, Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn, president of Neshama, Association of Jewish Chaplains, engages with diverse faith leaders across America to discuss personal and religious connections to Israel. In this program, Rabbanit Alyssa is in conversation with Anila Ali. This program was pre-recorded on May 17, 2024, and presented to an audience of NAJC members on May 19, 2024. Let me turn it over now to Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn.
Welcome, everyone, to Let's Talk, Interfaith Voices on Israel. My name is Alyssa Thomas Newborn, and I am the Rabbanit of Congregation Netzivot Shalom in Teaneck, New Jersey. I'm also a board-certified chaplain at a local New York City hospital and the president of Neshama Association of Jewish Chaplains. And it is my privilege tonight to host our fourth and final in this four-part series, Let's Talk Interfaith Voices on Israel. I want to express tremendous gratitude to our speaker tonight, Anila Ali, our listeners, and our co-sponsoring organizations, Netzivot Shalom, Moisha House Based Inn, the International Rabbinic Fellowship, and Neshama Association of Jewish Chaplains. Now, as you know, in this series, we have been hearing diverse faith leaders across America discussing their personal and religious connections to Israel. Each of these sessions features a positive interfaith bridge builder, and our sessions are virtual and recorded, so they'll be accessible afterwards on Neshama Cast, which is Neshama Association of Jewish Chaplains podcast. You can find Neshama Cast wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts. So this series began in response to the division, distrust, and isolation that the Jewish community has felt since the horrific events of October 7th. As well as the loss of interfaith relationships among friends and colleagues, and of course, the shocking rise in anti-Semitism, especially in recent weeks. As a reminder, the purpose of this series is not to discuss the specifics of the Israel-Hamas war. It's to share positive stories and connections across interfaith communities. When we hear directly from a person face to face, as we'll be with Anila tonight, we have the ability to access truth and our shared humanity. So through these sessions, what we've been striving to do is build positive connections around Israel through our diverse faiths relationships to the Holy Land and get a window into the heart of a person and a community that we may otherwise not have access or be able to hear right now. So I am extremely proud and grateful to say that I've worked with or partnered with or learned from each of the four people who've presented in this series, and I cherish their ongoing friendship and leadership. So now, without further ado, in tonight's session, as I mentioned before, we have the privilege of hearing about Anila Ali's personal and religious relationship with Israel. She'll share her voice and heart as a faith leader who is a dear, dear friend of the Jewish people. I'm going to begin by sharing your bio, and then we'll begin our full conversation. Anila Ali is an ambassador of peace, a Pakistani American Muslim women's rights activist, bridge builder, and peacemaker. She is a grassroots community leader, public school teacher, and Muslim philanthropist committed to strengthening America and her native South Asia and the Democratic Party. She's been an advocate for education, women's empowerment, and minority rights in America, and has written extensively to advocate for diversity and inclusion, and continues to be a voice for Muslim American women. She challenges stereotypes and bigotry. She empowers the disadvantaged, and she speaks truth to power without fear. Hanila Ali has twice been elected delegate to the Democratic National Convention. She represented the 45th Congressional District at the 2012 and 2016 conventions, and she was the first Pakistani and first Muslim to be elected in Orange County. She's an amazing fundraiser and centrist voice, and is especially known for co-founding AMWEC, which is the American Muslim and Multi-Faith Empowerment Council. It's a women's empowerment council where she organizes Muslim women coming together, the first conference, the inaugural conference in 2009. And of course, I'm going to ask you to speak more about this. I'm sure that you could say it better than I am in the bio. But you recruited a core group of leadership of very successful South Asian women who encountered the post-9/11 discrimination and were feeling underrepresented in the existing male-dominated Muslim civic groups. AMWEC takes on the challenge of external and internal bigotry by empowering Muslim women on the front lines. Inspired by their own journeys as immigrants who have prospered in America, AMWEC's women leaders unite, strengthen their communities, confront bigotry in all forms, celebrate cultural heritage, and build enduring bonds with fellow Americans of all faiths. AMWEC launched its first internship to encourage young Muslim women to explore law enforcement careers and offers helplines and guidance and assistance to women who are facing domestic abuse, internal or external bigotry, etc. So it's really an amazing, amazing organization. You also run Interfaith Ramadan Iftar, bringing together Muslims, Jews, Christians, Baha'is, and Hindus. And as if you haven't already created enough things in the world that are creating goodness and positivity, Anila Ali co-founded the CALPAC, which is an organization that provides quality education to disadvantaged children in remote areas of Pakistan. Anila Ali grew up in the region where both Hindu and Muslim children live in poverty. And so you work with CALPAC, created CALPAC, to ensure that all children in the region receive 12 years of quality education. I want to just personally, before we fully begin our conversation, take a moment to thank you just from my heart. Certainly for you being here tonight and spending time with us having this conversation. I also received already, I've been the recipient, and I can only imagine the children and the women and anyone who has been marginalized feeling that from your heart as well. You've given me comfort and strength. I wrote about this in a Times of Israel article, and I spoke about it in our congregation. Years ago, I had the opportunity to speak at the AMWEC conference in Orange County, and that's the first time that I met you. But then our paths thankfully crossed again a few weeks ago when we joined on a panel with prayer on disrupting the Uyghur genocide. And you are such a humble and strong heroine, and I feel so privileged to know you. For those who maybe didn't hear me say this already, Anila told me to never let others make me afraid of being proud to be a Jew, to fight anti-Semitism as it's the greatest threat to all of us. And she also said that she and other brave allies would be standing with us to do what's right. Your story is remarkable and your support is invaluable. You are a true leader and friend of the Jewish people. So thank you again for joining us tonight, and we are so excited to learn more from you.
Me too, Rabbanit. And it's so great to see you after so many years in New York, and to see that both of us in our journey of faith have landed up in the East Coast. And may this be a blessed move for all of our people. And it was great meeting you that day. And the prayer, it fulfilled my heart to be there with everybody and say, there are always good people in this world. We just have to, hold their hands and tell them to join us.
Absolutely. And I think it's inspired me, I think, especially in moments where we've experienced darkness recently, that our shared humanity is what binds us, and we have to show up for each other in all of our, unfortunately, there is suffering, there is evil in the world, and we have to show up for each other. The good people, even when it's frightening, need to show up. So
Absolutely, yeah.
I'll start with our first question, which is really a very open question. We want to get to know you, so please tell us a little more outside of your bio about your background, your work, and your faith community.
So I was born in Pakistan, to parents and grandparents who had built a country, called Pakistan. and it was born in 1947. It was Muslims and a lot of other religions that wanted religious freedom, wanted to practice their religion freely. And so, as the British just divided the Hindus and the Muslims in India, Pakistan was given to us. But at the same time, it was a mass migration of people, Hindus going into that side of India, leaving everything that they, cared for, their lives, their families, their heritage, and going to a new country called India, which is supposed to be their homeland. And then for us and my family coming from India, leaving everything that they owned, whatever their lives were for 300, 400 years. 4 centuries they lived in India, and then all of a sudden coming to a new country and building it. But those were the lessons that I grew up with, enlightenment. And I think the reason that you find me different, I always wonder, like, why am I doing this? Why aren't, my kids so passionately getting out there and doing this? But it's because we know what religious freedom is all about. We know what it's like when somebody wants to take away your heritage, who you are. And my grandparents and my parents teaching me the value of speaking out. My father would always say that it's the pen, remember, is mightier than the sword. And that was what the Prophet of Islam had said, that the ink of a scholar is far greater than the sword of a warrior. So growing up with those kinds of values, and acknowledging the role that women played, my grandmother, she was the patriarch of the family, or matriarch of the family. And she died when she was something like, God bless her and give her Jannah, Ameen. She was something like 98 or something. My paternal she was my paternal grandmother. She founded Pakistan. Not only that, she started a women's movement in India for Pakistan. Imagine, like, so many years ago,
So
she
brave.
was the first Muslim in a Hindu Congress elected. Today people get appointed. She was elected by the people. She taught herself how to read and write because she told my grandfather it was the custom of that time that, women would get married when they are very young. They're hitting puberty and it's time to get married. It was cultural. So she got married and had my father at 14. And then she told her husband, who was he was a journalist and he was a civil rights big leader with the founder of Pakistan. And she said, "You call yourself a leader? Your wife doesn't know how to read, and you're going to teach me how to read." And imagine a woman at that time. I mean, for me, that just that thought is liberating, And then my grandfather taught her how to read, how to write, and she wrote 14 books on women and Islam.
That is unbelievable. And also the fact that she could say that to him and he could hear her.
Oh,
I mean,
yes. 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 The other day we were having a women's conversation and there were some men there. And they were, we said, okay. And one of them said, my husband lets me, he lets me go to college. And so this gentleman who's a part of our, he's one of our male allies, he said, "He lets you?" And she said, "Yes, he lets me do this, he lets me do that." And those are the kinds of things that I didn't see in that generation, in that very enlightened generation, because my grandfather did not let her. He just said, "You have to." He didn't have any say in getting married. We have arranged marriages in back home. And so he said, "No, this woman is going to be a leader." And he was so happy. And for me to see, my father was similar, but my mother, she had a different upbringing. We had four or five siblings and cousins and little kids around. She wanted to be a homemaker. And so she was a housewife and a teacher. But my grandmother, no doubt, and all her siblings who were women, these were all leaders. So what happened to women's leadership? And then, as I was growing up, my father would hold my hand and take me on Sundays to churches, then to the Sikh Gurdwaras, and to the temples, the Hindu temples. And he didn't have to say anything. He taught me Islam because he walked Islam with me. He didn't have to sit there and say, memorize these verses in the Quran and pray. I knew what I had to do. My prayer was serving humanity with him and to understand and then go back. And, when I said my prayers, I knew what I was doing. So that aspect of the culture and my faith coming together was phenomenal. My grandmother, seeing her lead 500 women every Friday of her life, Shabbat. Her Shabbat was Friday, and after the men prayed and everything, 2 o'clock every day, I remember there were 500 women there, and do you know what she talked about? Women's empowerment. Because she was one of the leading figures of Pakistan's women's rights movement. And so how could I sit there and not do anything when I'm being told, yes, sister, you can go in the kitchen. And yes, we are meeting with the journalists from New York Times, but no, you can help us serve. I couldn't do that. And I said, first of all, I've seen a very different era. That's where I grew up, where my father was asking my grandmother for advice. The whole world was asking my grandmother for advice. These women were leaders. And Benazir Bhutto, she was the first ever elected prime minister of a Muslim majority nation. And then you have another country, Bangladesh, Muslim woman leader, India, which has a significant Muslim majority. I mean, they're going to have more Muslims there than Pakistan in the next 5 years. 300 million Muslims they're going to have, right? They had Indira Gandhi, phenomenal woman leader. So I feel like South Asia, we're gifted because we have examples of women leading and examples of women leaders in faith, coming out and saying, no, this is not okay. We are not going to stone our women for adultery. That was women in Pakistan. They rose up against that Hudud ordinance and they said, we're not going to, this is not going to happen. And they were able to, these women, parliamentarians, they were able to sit there and say, let's see, Islam is here, but kind of like, the Torah and the Talmud, they sat together and they said, no, we cannot stone women for adultery. We cannot lash women, this is not okay in today's world. At that time, it happened, but God has given us a rationale, a mind, an intellect. That's what I grew up with, Alyssa. And so for me, it was an incredible honor to have all these leaders and for them to say, yes, we had fights with the Hindus and the Sikhs and the British, but roll up your sleeves and work hard. There's no such thing as victimhood in my DNA. And that I feel has been the most endearing thing. I started doing a lot of interfaith work and I was meeting Sikhs and all. So in my family, I never knew this, that when there was partition, my grandfather, who got the house of a Sikh and their home was given to, Hindus and Sikhs in India in exchange. So we always knew this house was, belonged to a Sikh. And then the family had come from India to see that house. Can we see it after so many years? And my uncle told me the other day, a couple of years before when I was really getting into interfaith and building bridges, he told me, Anila, did you know the two of my aunts, they were young, beautiful girls, twins, and they were coming in the train from India. And there were Sikhs who had swords. They put the swords down and they raped them. They gang raped the two to my great grandmother's kind of. And they came to Lahore. And for Muslims, it was like the end of the world. And they committed suicide, both of them. And I said, I've never heard that story. That same story, that tragic story, could have been used to teach me how to hate. Teach me how to hate Sikhs, teach me how to hate Hindus, the British. I could have hated everybody. So I thought about it, and that was one of the points in my life where I said, I have to take that heritage. I have to take those stories and share them with people. That you are a nation of so many people, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. We have so many stories. We have so many hurtful stories and so many happy stories. We have to educate our children to be even better than us and to be even more powerful as Muslim faith leaders than my grandmother. You know, she was more restricted. And look at my daughter. I tell her, you live in America. You are so lucky you can do whatever you like. So go rule the world. And you know, of course, my father being the son of that woman, my grandmother, God bless her, he was, be the rebel you want to be. And no one was allowed to, of course, question Islam. And I would tell my father and my mother, and I'd say, I don't like praying because I don't understand anything. Why am I just going up and down and saying it in Arabic? I should be saying it in my language. And they would say, you know, my mother was a bit of a conformist. My father was the intellectual. And he said, so then figure it out. Go read up and learn it and say it in both languages. That's your challenge.
I love
So,
that
you
so
know, I,
much.
when I talk about my father, I feel we need more men like him in Pakistan and in India and every part of the world. But anyway, at least I can share his stories. So yeah, that's kind of a glimpse into my upbringing. My father was a diplomat. He was an intellectual, first journalist who founded the first news agency in Pakistan, and he was one of the youth leaders who walked across India, figuratively, to Pakistan. And I'm very proud to be his daughter today. And I know that he would be so proud to see that I'm following his legacy. His legacy was always children of Abraham. That was it. We are all children of Abraham, Hindu, Muslims, Christians, and Jews. We are children of Abraham. Never, ever did I hear anything anti-Semitic in my household or anti-Christian or anti anybody, and I want that world to come back.
Amen. I mean, he sounds like in our tradition we'd say like a tzaddik, which you know we have the same root words. He sounds like a truly righteous person, and the fact that you can point to your grandmother's legacy, I mean, you literally have walked in her footsteps and carried that forward. You've been a civil leader and representative of those who've been marginalized, and I love that she didn't just learn to read and write. She wrote 14 books. You know, she made it a practice
Yeah.
that she shared and opened her world to every Friday. I mean, it's I just feel like, you know, we're hearing these stories. You took us so beautifully into your world, and also you shared the pain. And I can't, you know, I pray that those aunts that you had, right? It was your aunts that you mentioned,
Yeah, my father, my mother's aunts.
that their souls have an ascension and are in peace. But what happened to them should never happen to anyone. It shouldn't have happened to them. I mean, that's horrific. And to learn that history, I appreciate you sharing that with us, and also modeling how to respond to such horrors.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to share now that you've mentioned when we went to after October 7th, we went to the kibbutzim. My dear brother, my ally, is a Sikh. He's on my board. His name is Simran Singh. And, you know, he was standing right next to me. He was on Lucy Aharish in the interview with me, sitting there. And I said, you know, Simran, after hearing all of these stories about the women, the atrocities that happened to them, I said, this is the first time in my life I'm thinking about my those two aunts. And I said, I want to share that with you, that this is, you know, this is what happened. But never, not once did I ever think you're Sikh and I'm Muslim. And I said, today we are here standing with the Jewish people. And I mean, isn't that what it's all about? That it's the crime against humanity. It is not what religion you are. It is not who you are. It is human being. And you know, he stood there with me throughout the trip. You know, we had to the kibbutz. We prayed together, and I mean, That's what we can tell our children. This is our legacy. This is what we do. This is what we can leave. There is nothing else that's more real than that.
It's so true, and it's also one of the most frightening things for people to do when they see evil and when they see fear
Yeah.
and suffering. So it is what we are here for, and also people who actually live it and do it like you should be praised and lifted up because it's not easy. And I'm wondering, since you did mention this trip, would you be able to tell us a little bit more about what the trip was and when you went?
Yes. I spoke at the March for Israel. And for me, it was something that I do as a human being. I don't remember ever being frightened to walk into a synagogue or a church and say, "Oh, my friends, my dear children of Abraham." So for me, it was just one of those days, Alyssa. And I did not tell anyone that I'm doing this because, it's the duty that I live every day. And nobody knew that I was going to do that. But when I actually went, I was very emotional. And as I stood looking at something like 270,000 Jewish friends and families there, and the young people that were in front of me, I looked at them and I swear to you, I hearkened back to my classroom when I was in California, when you knew me, and I was teaching the whole Holocaust. And
And
I
this is
myself did not know what the Holocaust was. I learned it on the job. And my mentor was Jewish, Karen Gottlieb, and she lives in California. And she came and she's telling some of our other colleagues, and she's a Muslim, and I'm a Jew. And they said, yeah, go. You like her. And she had her reservations and I had my reservations. She's my best buddy. If I have to go anywhere, I'm going to go to her. And we just bonded together and we started talking. And I said, "Do you know, Karen, that I lived in England. I have traveled around the world. I grew up in Pakistan. I never heard the word anti-Semitism. I didn't even know about the Holocaust. I knew Jews because they are people of the book. But I said, I didn't come across that hate. So something has really changed in our world." And so I was telling you that I'm standing there in front. I'm thinking all of these are my students. This is after 9/11, and I'm teaching the Holocaust curriculum, and I'm using it as a springboard for discussion because Muslim children are being targeted. I'm called terrorists. And Karen told me, "Anila, start like this. Talk about how hate is, how it, starts with stereotyping and, those little hurtful messages and, stink eyes and this. And somebody doesn't like somebody's hair, somebody's a nerd." I understood it all. And I looked at those kids and I said, "Oh my God, these children are going to go into a classroom. They're going to go to college campuses and they're going to face what my children and I faced." That was it. And I said, "I'm just going to speak from the heart." And unfortunately, what we see on campuses today is just that. You times it by 100. That's how bad it is. For us, there were Jewish people, there were Christians, there were many people standing with us as Muslims. For you guys, I'm sorry. I wish I could get more people than there are. I don't know any community in America who has done more for human rights than the Jewish community. And so if I speak and I put my life at risk and my friends here who are my colleagues who are Muslims and we have decided to dedicate our life to this cause, we do it because it is our duty. You were there for us and our children, and God knows we believe you are people of the book. Allah has in the Quran mentioned children of Israel 43 times. And it is all in context of the stories of Dawud alayhis salam, Prophet Dawud alayhis salam, all the Jewish prophets. We name our children after Jewish prophets. Our children, our girls are called Sarah, Sara, and our boys are called Daniel. That's my children. Daniel and Sarah, both from Judaism. Why did I look up Jewish names with my mother and father and call them, oh, that's Islamic names too, because we come from the Jews. So I think my own experience with enlightened parents and grandparents who experienced the world, they studied, they learned, they lived. It was very different. So for me, it was the right thing to do, to stand with the Jewish people. I didn't care if anyone stood or not, and I didn't care about the consequences. I didn't even think about them. I said, this is my duty. And when I did, I just said, these are the children. We have to protect them. You know, the adults, yeah, but these are vulnerable kids. They're going to go into these classrooms are the most dangerous in America. You know, that's where we have these kids. They become isolated, and then they go and they, you know, vent their frustration out. That's what motivated me to be there and to continue my work. I'm a teacher. I'm going to do that to adults and everybody that comes across me. And that is why, you know, after my speech, I said, okay, you know, what's happening in my community and media, in you know, everyone is saying Israel staged it. And I said, no. Let me tell you why I went. I was in Morocco. We were having a Muslim and interfaith women's conference to celebrate their, you know, embrace of the Abraham Accords and to empower the Moroccan women. They wanted to hear from us, American Muslim women. And I met with the Vivian Silver's group and Palestinian Sunshine group. They were going to have a rally on the border of Gaza and Israel. And there they said, Anila, after my speech, there were women crying because I told the story that I was telling you. And I said, you know, don't tell me I don't know Islam just because I don't, you know, I'm not a man. I am Islam. I have to walk Islam. And they were all in tears. They said, we are with you and this and that, Moroccan women. And they said, these two groups, they said, you have to come and speak at the Mothers for Peace rally in Israel on the 4th of October.
The 4th of October. Oh my gosh.
So it was June, I was in Morocco. July, they kept communicating and said, oh, you're going to stay with your Palestinian sister in Gaza in a family. You know, nothing had happened at that time. But I knew that because I have been close to the Jewish community and I've had to face more danger for my life here in America than anywhere else in the world. So I said, I'm not feeling comfortable because, you know, a lot of the Palestinian leaders, they also know me. And I said, I know that if they find out, they have, you know, I'd taken groups of Muslims to Muslim Americans, you know, faith leaders and imams to Israel for the past, you know, 2 years we've been doing that. And I said, they've already got fatwas. Palestinian Authority knows me, but they don't obviously want this to happen. And Hamas and everyone, Taliban too. So I said, you know, I wrote back on the 26th of September, finally, after us asking all my advisors and remembering what my children had said, Mom, we want you to be alive for us. And I said, you know, I don't think I can stay with my Palestinian friends and family that are there. I appreciate it, but is there a hotel on that side? They said, no, there's a kibbutz. I had seen these kibbutz before, and I didn't think that they were secure. I didn't feel secure like I do in Tel Aviv and I do in Jerusalem when I take my groups there in Haifa. So I said, no, I'm really sorry. Please tell Vivian I would do anything for peace, but this time, my sisters, I can't come. And that was 26th of September. So when this happened, I thought about myself, and you know, I would not go alone. I would take a couple of my women. And I said, you know, they would have taken me and made an example of me that this is what we do to Muslim women who speak and who stand with the other. And for me, what happened to those women was a message to me too. I'm a woman. And to have done what they did to the women and the families. And yes, there were Muslims there as well. There was a Muslim woman who was shot from her neck right down to her toes. And she was hijabi, she was Bedouin, and her husband was Ghazan. He was a Ghazan. Ahmad was Ghazan. And they didn't care because they are evil. They are evil personified using my religion and saying the sacred words that I say in my prayers. I say Allahu Akbar so many times. And now, every time I say it, I have the horrific images of those evil perpetrators taking, things and cutting the body parts of women who are Ahle Kitab. Now, the Prophet of Islam, Quran, they condemn any kind of violence, even in the time of war against seniors, children, and women. Women are the honor of a nation. So when that happened, it was very personal. We all stood up and we said, we are going to go and see. And how dare anyone say that Israel is staging it? And we went there and we sat and we saw and we witnessed and we cried and we came back and we said, we're going to tell our truth. And if that means we lose some people, like our close loved ones and my family, then at least we know that when we go and we meet Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, who is closest friend of Allah in the Quran, we will tell him, Prophet Abraham, we stood up for all our people, not just one of them. And that was it. That was truly my faith, my motivation, and the teaching of my parents and my grandparents. They never taught me to hate.
The fact that you were there, you visited, you saw, and you felt called to do that, and you brought other people in Israel, that you went and visited, that you spoke at the March for Israel. And I was one of the people in the audience of all of those many people who was just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it's her. I'm so happy to see her face. But that you looked at those Jewish children in the front rows, and I mean that you showed up and felt that personal peace. I mean, I think it just moves me to like want to sob. It's just such a comforting embrace. And it's what every people deserves. It's true, as you said, we've been persecuted in different points in history, and we have to stand up for each other and we show up for each other. And you mentioned what's happening on college campuses. I'm wondering, I guess I want to ask two questions. The first, especially since we are talking, the topic is also your relationship with Israel. I'm wondering if that was your first time in Israel, if you know what your relationship is with Israel itself, if you want to speak more to that. And I'm also,
Yes.
yeah, and I'm wondering too if you can speak to how is the Muslim community and your community, maybe the Pakistani community, responding to the anti-Semitism, because you're doing it and modeling it. And I'm wondering, if you can give us a little bit more of a lens into the world you're inhabiting too.
Yes, this was not my first trip to Israel. This was I think my love for Israel came when I went to challenge everybody's biases against it. And that was like 2018. But before that, if you remember the Olive Tree Initiative, we came to America to be free, to be able to pray the way we want to live the way we want to speak, to say what we want. We came here for the values and the freedoms. We all did that. Religious freedom also, because there are so many my friends who are Shias, who are persecuted in many countries, Ahmadiyya, and many Baha'is, and now Iranians and Afghans. I mean, so many people come here to be the role model American in the world. And now I feel that sorry, I'm losing my track. So tell me, what was
So
the
why
first?
in your Yeah, because I'm remembering you said you did actually take other Muslim groups, Muslim women, so
Yes,
you
yes,
visit
yes.
Israel, your
Sorry.
history, your relationship with Israel, and then also how your community responds to anti-Semitism.
Yes, okay. So my relationship with Israel began when I came to California and I met with all amazing Jewish leaders. And I said, you know, my father had told me, Anila, if you're making your home, America, your home, do it, but learn from the Jewish people. You know, they came here from all over. They have become successful. They ch educate their children, and that should be your thing. Educate your kids. I didn't pay attention to it at that time because I came to Irvine, and Irvine, most of my kids' neighbors and friends, they were all Jewish. And I said, I feel at home, you know, kosher and halal, and they get it, and we pray and whatever.
That huge grocery store with all the different choices.
Super Irvine. And it
Yeah.
was so beautiful because it was a Muslim Iranian and I think a Jewish Iranian, right? So, I mean, that was the beauty of Irvine. And that's where my kids grew up. In a way, I grew up too. I was young. And I said, okay, these are my friends. And I started seeing a movement to kind of hate Israel, right? So I said, I'm American. America has relations with Israel. And America has relations with Pakistan. America has relations with Saudi Arabia. But America has a close allyship with Israel. And, you know, because I wasn't really, no DNA, no hate for Israel, I stood up at that first rally they had in Orange County, which was a BDS. And I said, no, BDS is not okay. First of all, you don't boycott. You'll never make peace and you'll never get to know people. My father always said this, you know, he's the leader, he's the builder of Pakistan. And he said, no boycotts. You never stop conversations, you know? And so I said, I walked in all Israeli flags. That was the first time ever. It was Tarbut or Torah. I don't know if you remember that school. And I'm there with my friends. And of course, I took a picture. I never posted it because, you know, they were like, people were concerned that you're a Muslim and you're doing this. And I said, you know, how could these people be so bad? Like, what are they talking about? I don't think so. And then to challenge myself, I went to UCI after the Irvine 11, the whole breakdown of conversations between Muslims and Jewish kids. And I said to Beth Crum, who was our mayor, and I said, let's get together. Yes, let's build a coalition of Muslim community members, Christians, Jews, community members, faculty, and kind of law enforcement to keep the campus climate safe for all of our children. And we built the Olive Tree Initiative, which turned out to be one of the premier peace building and conflict mediation programs. All of these campuses, we were taking Muslim kids, Turkish, Armenian, to see, you know, can you learn about the conflict? Put your sides aside and say, how about what's our end goal? We all want peace. Yes, it may not come this way. It may not come this way. It may come this way. Let's find that middle ground. That's what we train kids to do on the campuses of California. And we would take them to Israel, to West Bank, Judea and Samaria, and then to Gaza. And so, you know, finally, when I really was getting into politics and our organization was really picking up as, you know, an ally, we had Israel was an ally with us. And personally, I was a Democrat, and that's in our party. I have, you know, and I'm an American. So I never shied away from it. And then I said, okay, you know, people are coming and saying, you know, you're a Muslim, the Jews use you, and the Christians, they'll take your pictures and you can never be close to them. It's in the Quran. I said, listen, I know, brother, how it's in the Quran. It's in context and it's at that moment. And I said, if that's the thing, then we should be also, the Quran says, you know, seek the pagans out and kill them. We should be killing everybody in that way. So they said, no, the Jews. And I said, look, I don't agree with what you're saying. So please, like, yeah, we'll build our own movement. That's when my father had said, build your organization, take your own stand. And so I said, okay, I'm gonna go and take a group of Muslims, community members, and I'm gonna go to Israel and I'm gonna check it out and see. And so I went to PLO offices, met with Hanan Ashrawi and all the leaders of the Palestinian Authority. And we went into the Jenin, you know, the very dangerous area. We met with the leaders of the opposition to Hamas who had lost. Imagine that. And that was 2018, 2019. And one of them, I have a picture with him, and he said, "You know, Sister Anila," he couldn't really expose his face. He said, "I've come here to tell you that the Hamas leaders, they are all corrupt. They keep their families with foreign passports in France and England and America, and they keep getting pensions from the money that comes in for their mother, grandmother, mother-in-law. They are so corrupt. They have millions of dollars." And you know, he had lost, and he was a good guy. So we met him secretly. Of course, I had discussions with PLO and Hanan Ashrafi, and I said, "Hanan, you know, I come from Pakistan, a country where women lead. So I'm very happy to see that you're there." But I said, "You know, Benazir came back and she fought against extremism, and that's why she died. She fought, she was against Taliban. Taliban martyred her. This woman was martyred." And she said, "Yes, I met Benazir, and Pakistanis are like this." And I said, "I," and then she complained about how the Palestinians don't believe in their Palestinian land, and they keep selling their homes, and they don't send a single penny back to Palestine. So I said, "And you want me to go to President Trump and ask for money? I don't think that's right, you know." And I said, "You also sound like the first people that are asking me to go to President Trump and ask for money for you." And I said, "You know, the Arabs tell me they've given you $81 billion." And I said, "Where is the, I see you have more progress than there is in Pakistan." And I said, "Our kids don't have education. I see all the kids have French teachers teaching them. They have backpacks, and you have running water in Jenin." And I said, "You have you own the land till 99 years." And I said, "I see where the oppression is." And I said, "The oppression is here because what you have are posters of little children. That's not jihad. You're asking $15,000." I told Hanan. And I said, "The children, give your children for jihad, 15,000, teenager, 25,000. I wanted to take a picture in Jenin of that. I was trying. You know, I had my phone and it was down. They weren't allowing us to do that. And I kept it down. But I was walking and I said, oh shoot, at that time. And I said, I should have taken a picture because that sealed the deal for me. And I said, these people are brainwashing their people to use Islam to fight their own proxy, some kind of war at that time.
I
And
can't
I came
believe
back.
that you've met with these people and like been on the inside of this. It's, I mean, because I it's so hard to even imagine. Like
Yes. So a lot of people, Alyssa, that you know have been watching me, they'll say, "Oh, you know, it's overnight." No, my love for peace is not overnight. The reason I went to Israel is to help the Palestinians, because I'm a Muslim too, and I don't hate Hindus and India and Sikhs. I want to help them get out of this hatred. I want to help them do what the Emiratis have done, the Moroccans are doing. Embrace your Abrahamic heritage. That is Islam. That's where we came from. You know, our burying rituals, our money, we don't, you know, we don't, we have our Islamic banking very much. Everything is like the Jews. Why are you know, saying they are your enemy? What Quran are you quoting? You're not even understanding it. And why aren't you looking at the life of the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him? Because his mother was Jewish. His great grandmother was Jewish. And he didn't have a problem saying, oh, I'm going to take my entire new Muslim population and go to the Jewish tribes in Medina for refuge. When the pagans were, you know, persecuting him and his people, where did he go? He went to where his mother came from, the Jewish tribes. Why aren't you talking about that? And they don't want to do that. And so you bring that perspective. They don't want that. They don't want that. But that's what I grew up with. That's what every Muslim child needs to hear about the Prophet of Islam and who he was and where he came from and his love for the people of Abraham. And humanity in that way. So anyway, that was my relationship. So yes, it wasn't overnight. I knew the Jewish people, I knew Israel, I had studied, I had read books, and I was preparing myself for, perhaps God was preparing me for this role. And I knew that today, you know, you tell me, ask me a question. I probably know a lot more about many people. And I tell them, you may disagree with me, so come and talk to me. And I'll tell you what I have seen with my eyes. I didn't want to have my Muslim friends say, oh, you haven't even been there, because my father always said, bear witness. That's what he did when when Pakistan and Bangladesh, they had a bloody war, and Pakistanis killed a whole lot of Bangladeshis brutally. It was a very bad war. And my father said, I'm going to go. He told the prime minister at that time, Benazir's father, and he said, I'm going to go and I'll tell you what the truth is. He came back and he said, oh, terrible atrocities. In fact, I was reading his books. This was his book that he wrote. And it was his lasting legacy that he said, no, we committed atrocities. We were people. And because of politics, we killed so many Bangladeshis. That's the book. And I went to bear witness, which is what I did many times afterwards. And I came back and I said, talk to me. We have to get our Palestinian brothers and sisters out of that mentality, which Hamas has been, brainwashing their children with. We know what happens in the schools. Oh my gosh, in Jenin, there were Jewish people from Israel that had set up an art center. They were teaching the Palestinian kids in, and these are not camps, by the way, it's a city. I told them, I've been to a camp in Pakistan for the Afghan refugees. It's made of cloth. And I said, you guys have buildings. You have running water. You have your own city. A camp for me, the Afghan camp, was, no running water, tents made of, just canvas. And I said, no schools and no education for the Afghans even today, because obviously the Pakistanis want them to go back to Afghanistan now. And they can't work. They have to stay in that UN mandated area. And I said, I always thought that they were all Palestinians were in camps. And I said, Jenin is not a camp. But I said, maybe the camp is in here. Let's change it. Let me show them there's a different way. There's a way of peace, and let's get together. Let's educate your kids. So my slogan became books, not bombs.
Oh, wow.
And when I was saying that, obviously already people were, raising eyebrows. Why is she saying that? Because it's the truth, and truth hurts. People use the truth and they twist it and they turn it. But no, the truth is books, not bombs. I want to give that. So I began my advocacy in 2019, met with all of them, and then obviously met with the leaders who lost from Hamas, and they told us about Gaza. And I said, oh my God. Then I went back to the Emiratis, who had already 15 years ago started settling the Jewish people from Israel and saying, we have realized, we've got to stop. They call it re-engineer the extremism in Islam. So I said, oh, brothers, thank you so much for doing that, because you ruined a country right next to you, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Talibanization, and all the money coming in from Arab countries was going into Hamas, Wahhabization, Wahhabism. And all of a sudden, women can't work, and then women have to cover up, all of that. Jihadi culture, basically, that you life is not important. No. All of that is all, Wahhabism gone wrong, Islam being used by people. So I said, I'm so thankful to you, to my Emirati brothers and sisters who were, the leaders of that UAE Abraham Accords. And I said, thank you for doing that. I'm at your service to the world. And we came back and we said, we have to do this. We have to quietly say to Palestinians and Muslims that there is no other way but peace. If Arabs want it, Israelis want it. And you can see a man in guttura, the red guttura that the South Emiratis wear, and you can see a man in a kippah, and they're walking into a kosher and a halal restaurant in UAE. That's bliss. That's heaven on earth. And we are going to stand for it. So when they came to us and they said, we're doing this, we said, okay, we are with you. Your sisters are right here. And we started doing all of that. and many trips. We took lots of Muslims, and as we were taking them, yes, we were kind of countering a lot of the misconceptions about the whole Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and people were not liking it because, as we know, in our country, we've got people who don't want us to be cousins and long-lost siblings come together, and that was the tide, and that's the tide now that you see happening. And unfortunately, what I see is my community. At first, of course, my women, especially, they were attacked, brutal attacks on them, and to the point where they had nightmares, or like they weren't allowed to go into the mosque. It was Ramadan, because they said, "Oh no, you are with the Jewish people. You have to resign from this. You have to do this. You have to stop your support for Nila and AMWORK and all that." And my sister, who was very active politically in Pakistan because of my family background, her husband was harassed and said, "Oh, your looks like your sister-in-law is a Jewish spy and CIA and Mossad." So my family had to leave Pakistan for a while because it became an international incident.
Because your trips to Israel and trying to build
No,
a
because of my speech at the March for Israel.
because of your speech at the March for Israel recently,
Yes.
your family had to leave Pakistan.
Sorry. I'm so sorry about that. Oh my gosh.
No, that's fine. Your family had to leave Pakistan.
My sister and my brother-in-law, they had to leave Pakistan for a couple of months. And then, I say my parents up there must have been watching over all of them, that things changed very dramatically. And what happened was, with the movement that I was doing on religious freedom, a lot of the imams that I had been working with for the past 10 years and building bridges, they said, "No, we support Sister Anila. She's talking about the people of Ibrahim. And yes, we don't want the Palestinians to die. Nobody does, you know? And that is why we're saying come together, you know, let's just sit down and talk. We're neighbors." And then they had a meeting of imams to say, "What did Sister Anila do?" And the imams who knew me and my family and all, they said, "She's done nothing wrong. This is her speech. This is what she said." And so there were calls of, like, "Let's ban her organization. Let's close her. Why is she?" You know, my schools were also affected, attacked. Children were safe, and I was like pulling back because I didn't want the children to be affected there. But yes, everybody around me was affected. In fact, my son was saying, "Mom, I believe you have a right to free speech and whatever you want to, but a lot of my Muslim friends, not the American friends, non-Muslims, but a lot of my Muslim friends, they quieten up. They're like, 'Oh, okay, we can't talk about it. Her, his mom.'" And so that kind of stuff that going on with my children, who weren't angry with me, that, "Mom, you did this because of my own advocacy." And they saw that I made difficult, I took these very different stands at different points. For the Syrians, I went to President Obama. For the Pakistanis who were being killed by our drones, 70,000 Pakistanis were killed in the north because of our war on terror. I went to President Obama. I said, "I voted for you. I was your delegate. And please don't do this because this will create more." And then he said, "We have Osama bin Laden. Look at this, look at this, look at this." And then I went back to Pakistan. I said, "Please get rid of your terrorists. Get rid of them. We are not a nation of terrorists." I never shied away from speaking about terrorism and going and doing the difficult thing, whether it's the Rohingyas. We went with Republicans and Democrats. We said we want a safe zone for the Rohingyas. They died. Their women are still being sex trafficked and raped in the in they live in real tents. They have canvas tents, and there are million Rohingyas living there. They suffered a real genocide by the Myanmar army, and nobody said anything. We didn't have anything for the poor Rohingyas, Uyghurs. Nobody cares, right? So why is there selective outrage? Why? And we know that. We know it now. And that's what we are fighting to get rid of. We're saying, it's your hate, get rid of it. Read, educate yourself, and know that in the end, we have to build peace. Because if today Israelis and Palestinians can come together, India and Pakistan can come together. Kashmiris can have their own homeland. They can, like Palestinians, they can also have their homeland. Does anyone, you know, go on campuses and do what they're doing for the Kashmiris? No, nobody does. But yes, somebody has taught people to hate, our children to hate here. And we've got to change that back rapidly, or we're going to lose a whole generation. And yes, now I would say, so I want to give you some hope.
Yes, and
Now,
so I know I want to be mindful of the time too, and
yes.
Appreciate so deeply your time. I want that hope. So please give us the hope. And that would be how we end. But I also really want to say that, and I'm going to speak on behalf of myself, but also everyone listening. We want to stand up for you and be there for you, just as you have done for us, which I know you said is just what we did for you, but truly, what you have sacrificed, the courage you have, including to speak with us tonight. I mean, you have given so much, and you have such moral clarity. And I know it comes from, you know, your father and your mother and your grandmother's legacy. And I, you know, I'm thinking of how, you know, how she wrote the 14 books. I mean, you don't just show up for people. You create multiple organizations, you fly around the world, you try to bring people together. You're tireless even when it hurts you. And I want to ask how we can support you and the community work you're doing too, because we, you know, we need to do that. That's the right thing to do. So please give us the hope, and also please tell us what we can do.
Thank you, Alyssa. The hope is that things have changed, you know, drastically. And it really makes me feel that, you know, God is watching over us, because there are men, Muslim men, who come to me and say, you don't know how incredibly proud we are. And when that happens, you know, I know that there's change is going to come. I was one person who was standing for the Jewish people and Israel on that day. Today, we, alhamdulillah, we have been able to hire 3 more Muslim women. And we have, you know, Muslim woman in Boston. And then we have a couple of them in New York, which is why you'll keep seeing me there.
For Amwek.
And then for AMWEC, and then we have 3 women working full time to, you know, empower other Muslim women to fight hate and stand with you guys right now, and then with everybody else whenever they need us. And that's the Muslim women leadership we want to grow. So yes, I mean, we are a nonprofit, so you can, you know, donate to us. That's number one way, but also elevate our voices, you know, where you have connections with media, CNN and, you know, Fox News and whatever media do you have. Please tell them we want to hear these Muslim voices, women's voices. You know, we always see a man and he's going to be representing all the Muslim. Well, Muslims are not monolithic. We're all very different. And definitely, alhamdulillah, we represent the largest Muslim majority, which is the Asian, South Asian. So India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Egypt, you know, we have Azerbaijan. We have all these Muslim countries that are so beautiful and so diverse. We represent all of them, which is the majority. And so, you know, ask us to come speak. We have a Muslim Women Speakers Bureau, which we're growing. So if you ever need a speaker, and we have experts, Muslim experts, on Holocaust, on anti-Semitism, on extremism, on women's rights in Islam, and you name it. We're developing all of that. We, of course, we have our own internship programs. What we want to do, we envision a next generation of Muslim women leaders, men and women who stand together against extremism, build a world where America, where Muslims fight anti-Semitism and Jews fight Islamophobia, and together we fight hate. And so if you can help us with that, please do. But most importantly, this is the most important thing, follow us on social media and elevate us, share our words and our, you know, whatever we're doing, our advocacy. That's the most important. And we're all everywhere. Yes, I'm going to give you the...
For anyone who's listening right now too, especially from when this is a podcast, can you just share what that would be if they wanted to find you?
Yes, so first of all, just look for me, ANILA, Anila Ali. And then if you just Google American Muslim and Multi-Faith Women's Empowerment Council, you'll see we are on Facebook page, we're on Twitter, we are everywhere. We're also on TikTok. Follow us Instagram, Anila Ali and AMWAC. Follow us on both and just elevate. My board members are Soraya Deen, Zeba Zebunnisa, who are here. We are in DC advocating for humanity, and Farhana Khurshid. So four of us from different Muslim communities coming together to make America stronger.
Thank you for everything that you do, for giving us that hope. I want to ask you one last question, if it's okay. You said that thankfully things have changed, and I'm wondering if you know what changed, how it changed, because that can also help us understand better what we're up against and how we can bring peace.
Yes. So initially it was that, so many innocent people are dying. And obviously the Muslims are saying, if you're a Muslim, then you have to cry for Gaza and not for Israel. Well, there was that discussion going on and people were dividing us. And now what they're seeing is an erosion of Muslim values, Islamic values, that we are not willing to listen to each other. In fact, just before I spoke, they're saying, why are we silencing women or people of different opinions? We're not willing to listen to each other. That in itself is very un-Islamic, because the Prophet of Islam, he encouraged women to speak in his, in the first mosque that he built, he had a room for women who would come, and his wife went to him and said, "Ya Rasulullah, the women are coming and shouting at you. And I don't like that." And he said, "Let them vent. Let them speak." So why are women being silenced? Why are different? Where is the diversity of opinions in the Islamic world? We want our imams to come out and say, we are going to stand with the interfaith community. It doesn't matter what the geopolitics are. So people are seeing, like, all of a sudden, in the end, there is more Islamophobia now. They are being asked questions like, does Islam, do you get 72 virgins, which is not anywhere in the Quran? So they're actually getting a taste of, oh no, people are thinking our religion is bad. And their children are saying, the moderates are either going to the far left, or they're saying leave Islam. And people are having a lot of issues now thinking. And especially like in New York and places like that, I'm seeing a rapid change. That's why we're very active in New York. They're also saying that harassing the Jewish community because of geopolitics, you can have a problem with Israel. You can have a problem with Israel's policies, but these are our people. We are a democratic, humanitarian nation. We live together, and it's an erosion of Muslim values that you're seeing if you're saying, no, I'm not going to talk. I'm not going to go to a Jewish event, I hear. And I said, oh, I'm not going to meet with them. I'm never going to talk to them. That's not Islam. And so people in my community are seeing it and realizing that children will suffer the most, because when they go to get a job, how will they go as Muhammad Ali Khan? Then there are going to be people on the extreme right and left who are going to say, we don't want trouble. So hate, when we say hate affects all of us, it's just a circle. It will come round. And we just have to keep that in front of us and remind people, it'll hit you at some point. So stop it while you can. So they're getting it and they're calling us, and we're getting a lot more support. I was just on TV in a Muslim channel, and I'm going to go to travel again, Muslim countries, and I'm going to talk about interfaith. Also, Pakistan has changed, and my people are doing really well doing interfaith, and I'm hoping that I'm going to have the largest gathering, interfaith religious gathering, in August, inshallah, in Pakistan. So, good things are happening.
Thank you so much. I called you a heroine. You truly are. And I'm sure anyone listening and watching feels that. Any way we can support you, we want to and we will. And truly, thank you for your bravery, your courage, and your heart in joining with us. And we are with you as well. I want to thank Anila Ali, our speaker, our listeners, and our co-sponsoring organizations again, Netzivot Shalom, Moshe House Based In, International Rabbinic Fellowship and Neshama Association of Jewish Chaplains. This is the perfect end, the perfect finale to our series, Let's Talk Interfaith Voices on Israel. Hearing from you has been a tremendous gift. This podcast is going to be available on NeshamaCast and will continue to be going forward. We thank you again for joining us, Anila, and we wish the listeners and you a safe and joyful evening and safe travels in the work that comes next.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And shalom and God bless. Wa alaikum assalam.
Thank you to Rabbanit Alyssa Thomas Newborn and Anila Ali for their engaging dialogue. Check out this feed for the regular episodes of NeshamaCast, featuring conversations on Jewish spiritual care today. NeshamaCast is found on all major podcast platforms. Our theme music is A Nigun for Ki Anu Amecha, written and performed by Reb Cantor Lisa Levine. Please help others find the show by rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. We welcome comments and suggestions for future programming at neshamacast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow NAJC on Facebook to learn more about Jewish spiritual care happening in our communities. May we all work together to heal our world.